At that time, Rock, is he still involved in a physical way with Henry Wilson, or is he just meet? Because he has a type, and he starts going out with guys, and he has like that blonde, tall, masculine kind of guy type. And he meets a bunch of guys. He has relationships.
Right. Some of them are pretty short-lived. I didn't put this, I was originally, this was in the book, but then it was cut from the final print of it, if you will. He was involved with a car hop named Jimmy Dixon. It's kind of interesting. He was close friends with the actor George Nader, who was partnered with this man named Mark Miller. Mark Miller owned this little car hop. It was like a drive-in.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Dixon was one of the car hops there, and he just told this funny story that I wish could have remained in the book, where he said, you know, you have Rock Hudson and George Nader driving into this little eatery, and all of these gay car hops are fighting about who gets to go to the car and take the order, you know.
And he won.
Yeah, who's going to bring Rock and or George Nader the complimentary Coca-Cola that they're going to get, you know. Just a funny little anecdote, but... some of the relationships were pretty short-lived. There was one of more significance with a gentleman named Jack Navarre, who around the time of Magnificent Obsession was living with Rock. And it sort of passed into sort of Hudson lore or legend that the night of the premiere, Navarre was led to believe that he would be sitting alongside his companion, Rock Hudson, and then... sort of a fast one was pulled at the last minute, and he ends up with a starlet, and Rock is, of course, I think, sitting at the A table with Jane Wyman and Ross Hunter. And, you know, understandably, Navarre was upset and confronted Rock later, and it wasn't soon after that that relationship kind of disintegrated.
But Jeff, no, he didn't get it, that, you know, the brouhaha and the speculation and all those things. So was Rock still, did he have to stay physically connected to Henry, or was he able to just do that in the beginning and then was able to have his own relationships?
That part is pretty unclear, like how long-term was a physical relationship going on between Rock and Henry Wilson. With this whole stable of hunks that Wilson had at his disposal, so to speak, you know, Rock may have been his preferred dish, but I don't think that that was the only...
he had appetizers. And desserts. Yeah.
Right. So that was one thing that I could never definitively say for sure. Did it continue the whole time, you know, or... because Rock's interest certainly veered, as you said, toward the Marlboro man type.
Yes, like exactly. Blonde, the mustache, rugged. Tall, rugged-looking dude. And he had, you know, you have some nice pictures of some of the guys in there, and they were all pretty. It's like bingo. You know, younger ones, but, you know, they were more clean-cut, but still blonde, hunky kind of guys. And
one of the gentlemen, William Dawson, who was Rock's boyfriend for a while at the time of Pillow Talk, you know, he was a physique pictorial model.
I saw that physique. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, stunning. And we just lost William Dawson a couple of years ago.
Oh, wow.
Sadly,
Rock never really had a long-term relationship, did he? Oh,
probably
Tom
the
Clark.
Closest thing, Tom Clark, yes, who was a publicist, yeah.
I don't get that, do you?
He is really not in the mold of all the other boyfriends. He's pleasant looking, certainly, and was very smart, alcoholic, unfortunately. And in the beginning, a lot of people thought that he was good for Rock and that he could sort of get Hudson organized and on track and was acting more or less like a manager.
Right.
But then on the downside of things, when Clark's, you know, drinking really kicked in, he could be, as some of my interview subjects told me, pretty abusive toward Rock and kind of disparagingly refer to Hudson as the matinee idol when he was no longer that. Yeah, so I think that that's a complicated relationship. In some ways, it has pluses. It had pluses and minuses.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that very much down the road when Rock was dying of AIDS, it was Tom Clark that was kind of summoned back into Rock's life and to come back to the castle, which was the name of Rock's sprawling estate or the nickname for it.
27 rooms. Yikes.
Yes. Yes.
Who needs 27 rooms?
I know it. If you're Rock Hudson and you're the king of Hollywood, I guess you deserve it.
He did. He worked hard and he needed his plays off the beaten track. What I was going to ask you is, so we'll go back a little bit.
Sure.
You addressed the rumor that I always heard that when Confidential was going to do a story on Rock being gay, that they threw George Nader under the bus, and hence Rock would take care of him the rest of his life. And you said that rumor is not true.
Well, what's interesting is Nader's name is the one that's usually bandied about when we talk about this Confidential scenario,
right?
In that, you know, Henry Wilson, the agent, gets wind of the fact that this scandal sheet is going to expose Rock's homosexuality, and he's fearful that that kind of disclosure could single-handedly ruin Rock's career. So one of sort of the legendary scenarios that you hear is that, you know, they threw George Nader under the bus, which destroyed Nader's career, and then Rock could keep, you know, being the number one box office star in the world. What sort of blows that theory out of the water is Nader's career kept on going, and Confidential never did an expose about George Nader. The more believable scenario, I think, is they actually threw Rory Calhoun, ex-con, and the late Tab Hunter.
Yes,
who,
yes. The pajama party with a bunch of boys.
The all-male pajama party, as they expressed it, yeah.
I love
so
the
I think that is... Doesn't that seem the more plausible scenario,
but
Grace?
It now seems more plausible because what I read before, and a guy who wrote about Confidential said that it was Rory Calhoun as the jailbird. And I'm like, they'd give up a story about Rock Hudson being gay, which would have totally destroyed this guy's career, for Rory Calhoun's a jailbird. But then seeing that they had that and threw Tab Hunter under the bus, it makes sense to me, 100%. I didn't know that until I read your book.
Right, and not long before Confidential published that story about Tab Hunter, Tab had dismissed Henry Wilson as his agent.
Mm.
So that sort of also makes sense as a revenge.
Very much, yeah. We'll get into that a little later about his revenge with Rock. But So then this comes out, and people are saying, Rock's almost 30. Why isn't he getting married?
Right. And not only, you know, a scandal sheet like Confidential, but I think it's in sort of around 1955, Rock is on the cover of Life magazine, and they proclaim him Hollywood's most handsome bachelor. But if you look at the article inside, they kind of throw down the gauntlet and say, well, Rock Hudson better get married or explain why not.
Isn't that sick?
And
how horrible.
I mean, and this is a mainstream magazine,
yes,
not a tabloid, you know. So very startling. And the threat from Confidential was very viable. A couple of years before, they had essentially done the same thing with MGM star Van Johnson, where they said, they referred to him... I think they used the term "Lavender Lad," but
didn't
it was
he come
right out there?
But didn't Van then say that he had experienced some, but he had changed his ways, and now he was totally straight?
That I don't know. It's almost like an early. It's like a conversion.
Yeah, exactly. Conversion therapy. Yeah, I don't know. I read that. Well, this man wrote a book about Confidential, and I read the book about Confidential, and he was going to come on the show, but he was too nervous. And that was one of the stories he put out there, that Van had actually copped to it. But I can't believe that he did. I can't imagine copping to it and then saying he found the light, you know?
And, of course, there's that bizarre scenario where possibly under threat from Louis B. Mayer that Keenan Wynn divorces his wife.
Evie.
And she marries Van.
Yes.
Evie, yes.
Yeah. That was bizarro. Bizarro world.
Yeah. It just shows you what kind of an era that we were living in then, you know.
And very sad. Very sad for – and it made me sad for Rock because it's like, who do you trust? You can't write a love letter because just in case – if somebody has tangible evidence, And they're vindictive. They can use it against you. And it's just, you know, Rock was very aware of his image, and he did not want to be known that he was a gay man. And you know what? It would have ruined his career. So then Henry Wilson comes up with this brainstorm for Rock to get married.
Right. And this is, of course, to Phyllis Gates, who was Rock's, Henry Wilson's secretary. And she's really direct from Central Casting. You know, she's really pretty, and she seems all-American girlish. And mm-hmm. She was from Dawson, Minnesota. And you look at her and you think, yeah, church socials and picnics. And she just has that kind of aura about her. And
very wholesome.
Sunday school teacher. Yeah, very, very wholesome. Perfect, you know, consort for the King of Hollywood. And so there's, you know, depending on who you interviewed, if you interviewed 10 people, Grace, you get 10 different versions of what they think that relationship was all about. And I think looked at now, probably the most plausible scenario there is that in the name of job security, you know, Henry Wilson, again, stage managed this marriage. And but here again, some people that I interviewed said, no, I think that it may have started off that way, and then they, as inexplicable as it may be, Rock and Phyllis did develop some real feelings for one another, whereas other people you talk to say, no, that was a very dark chapter in his life, and he hated being manipulated that way. And
well, I can't blame him. I kind of believe that because, well, I've read other things, you know, like she was a lesbian, but this mm-hmm. whole thing that she wrote this memoir after Rock died, and she said, I had no clue he was gay. How did she not have a clue as Henry Wilson's secretary? Is she that?
Right.
I mean, please.
If trolley car conductors, you know, knew about Rock's sexuality, or extras and bit players did, how did Phyllis Gates, who's the secretary to Henry Wilson with all these hunks marching around, not know it? It seems pretty inconceivable.
Yes.
But in her 1987 memoir, My Husband Rock Hudson, she does kind of wants the reader to believe this, that she was very naive and wide-eyed and had no idea that she was sort of being duped into this sham marriage. And, you know, I just have to say, I don't find that scenario very convincing.
I don't either. It's like, give me a break, honey. And also what she did, which was very, I just found out about this too, because, you know, I put things up and I try to do things for the podcast and for our things I post. And I just found out that, and in your book as well, you write that she coerced Rock. She had taped him through a private detective and asking him leading questions and talking leadingly, making this whole tape of Rock admitting he's gay and her saying all these things. That was amazing to me.
Right. And it's Fred Otash, I think it was the private investigator. And the thing to consider there is not only does she apparently get him to confess about his gay affairs on tape, but then you have to think that those tapes would have existed. So even after the divorce, if somebody wanted to use them toward their own sort of sinister ends, they could. They could use that as blackmail material.
Exactly.
You have Hudson being surreptitiously recorded and confessing all
How
of
horrible.
It.
I think that's really awful. And you know that was used for. She showed it to him. Henry Wilson had to know. So I'm sure Phyllis did pretty darn good when they got divorced.
Right. What's fascinating that I also detail in the book is, you know, into the late 60s, early 70s, long after they were divorced, you can see in the Rock Hudson archives that Phyllis was still forwarding bills to the estate for things like visits to pharmacies or department stores.
Yeah.
So what is that about?
Really?
Why is Rock still footing her bills?
People are pretty devious, and it's really sad because that he had to carry that secret, and hence he was the perfect target for people to blackmail and to do these horrible things to. And I don't buy her story at all. I read it, and I'm like, oh, how long were they married?
I think it's from 55 to 58.
Wow, that long?
Right. I'm pretty certain that that is correct. Yeah. And interestingly, they married only 8 days before Rock's 30th birthday. So it's kind of just in a nick of time in a sense. You know, like in those days, if a man was unmarried over 30, I think that was pretty suspect.
How did Liberace get away with it? Because he was outed and confidential. That whole thing in England, the simpering, limp-wristed, prissy, blah, blah, blah. Liberace sued him and won. I didn't get that.
I think the headlining, confidential grace for Liberace was why Liberace's theme song should be Mad About the Boy.
Yeah, I saw that. They were wicked. But the guy who wrote the confidential book that I read, he said confidential got sued for telling the truth. You know what I mean? Like the National Enquirer gets sued for not telling the truth. Confidential got sued for telling the truth because they really tried to get the stories right and to, you know, there were also people, you know, do you know who Barbara Payton is?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. My friend, John O'Dowd, he was my first guest for the second season. He wrote a magnificent, and with the family's blessings, and they gave pictures, whatever, a biography of Barbara, and just did another one. But she, she would sell stories in the late 50s, you know, about Bob Hope and her, and then that she had an affair with Gregory Peck, who was so pristine. There was no brouhaha about him ever. And so it's pretty funny to me that, or odd, that it did not come out about Rock at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think George Nader said we used to wonder, had Rock either made a pact with the devil or did he have an angel on his shoulder, because he seemed almost untouchable by a scandal sheet like Confidential. And I think it's worth, you know, reminding your listeners that tabloid, if we want to use that term, launched in 52. And I remember reading that the founder, Robert Harrison, boasted that in just a couple of years after they launched it, the magazine had a readership of more than 4 million.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's sort of like Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons combined.
Yes.
So it's really the Access Hollywood or TMZ of its day.
But very, worse. Very, it's something very...
You know, much worse.
Yeah, nitty-gritty, where Access Hollywood doesn't out people or TMZ doesn't out people. And but this one just didn't care. They went down and dirty into the nitty-gritty of people's lives. And then, of course, they got sued, and they couldn't do stories about stars anymore. They had to do stories about other things, and it just went out of business. Let's talk a couple. Okay, so then Phyllis is in the picture. They get divorced. People are appeased. And Rock does another. He does I Love Written on the Wind. I think that's such a wonderful film.
That is.
Good actors. I mean, Lauren Bacall. He starred a lot with, what's her name? Dorothy Malone, right? He was in a lot of shows with her.
Yeah, Dorothy Malone. And that's her Oscar-winning performance in Written on the Wind.
She was great, that slut. She was
Mary
wonderful.
Lee, yeah.
Yeah, she was really good.
Yeah,
she's
probably the most memorable thing about the film.
Mm-hmm.
That whole, I think that sequence that most people, it's indelible. It's the Mambo of Death, as it's known, where her long-suffering father is, you know, making his way up the staircase to confront his very promiscuous daughter, played by Dorothy Malone, and she's upstairs doing the Watusi.
And that was hysterical.
She's clutching a framed photo of Rock because this is the only man she cannot have.
Yes.
And it's just, it's unintentionally hilarious.
It
is.
It's
also just this great operatic sequence.
I love it. I laugh. It is so funny. And I just love that movie. But let's talk for a moment about a movie I love. And I think it could have been Rock's finest acting, and it didn't do well. Seconds. I love that movie. Do you like that movie?
That is my favorite Rock.
Mine too.
Movie.
Mine too. And Magnificent Obsessions too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Seconds for me is, you know, this is Rock trying to diversify and break free from sort of the pillow talk formula.
Yes.
You know, the three films that he made with Doris Day were such enormous blockbusters that they sort of launch this whole succession of these films where he's
here. Gina Lollobrigida. Yuck. Yeah, he had no chemistry with her. Or any of this.
Right. It's
Doris, yes.
Item. Like,
yes, Doris.
Yeah, Doris, yes. Yes, sublime chemistry. But I think he got to a point where he said, well, I want to do something different, and I want to prove that I can, you know, be more than just, you know, handle more than just sophisticated comedy. So he really makes a radical departure. This, you know, project comes along, which is this dark dystopian thriller about, you know, a tired over 50 businessman sort of selling his soul and exchanging his identity for a younger version of himself. So you go from John Randolph, the actor at the beginning of the film, playing the tired businessman. Then he undergoes this radical personality transplant, and he emerges as Rock Hudson.
Yes, the whole thing, the facelift, he goes through rigorous exercise stuff. But the thing is, before they get Rock or John, what's his face, you know, drugged, and they take a picture of him mm-hmm. with a woman that looks like he's being raped. So he has basically no choice but to join the company, with Will Gear being
right.
the benevolent evil one. Grandpa Walton. Yeah.
Yeah, he plays it so wonderfully.
Oh, he's
too.
Great.
Yeah, and then the character, Rock emerges as that character, and he has difficulty adjusting to this new life.
He has a new name, new career.
New name. Yep, Tony Wilson. And he meets this mysterious woman who we're never sure, does she work for the company? Is she sort of a reborn?
Salome Jens.
As well.
Right.
Yeah.
Because he lives
yes.
in Malibu I, now, yeah. right?
Yes, correct. And, you know, the whole film, it's directed by John Frankenheimer.
Great. Manchurian Candidate yep. kids. Fabulous.
Yeah, and here's another installment in Frankenheimer's kind of paranoia trilogy, if mm-hmm. you will. And it's Rock Hudson at his most pure and raw. It's such a committed performance. A lot of it is nonverbal, and that's for any actor, that's really challenging. And I think Rock just took this on.
He
and
did.
It's to his credit. Yeah.
He was amazing yeah. in this film. In your book, I found out for the first time, he truly was bombed during that section. That scene where they had that big party and he starts like going back and remembering his past and you know all the reborns and other people who work for the company stop him, but he really got bombed, right? He wanted
yeah,
him to drink.
Yes, Frankenheimer encouraged that until the point that Rock was quite inebriated, and then
he cried.
Salome Jen,
yeah,
yeah, he did. Salome remembered that there was this launched into this crying jag, and it really scared everybody because Rock almost seemed to be having some sort of a breakdown
yeah.
on the set. And then none of that footage was really usable, so they had to come back and reshoot it. And, you know, Frankenheimer would employ other tactics. Like, there's a scene at the very end of the film where Rock is strapped onto a
How gurney. Good is that? Oh, my God.
Yes.
Yes.
And apparently Hudson became legitimately panicked when he realized he couldn't break free, that the straps were, you know, really constricting. And Frankenheimer said, no, don't release him, because that just sort of exacerbated this feeling of anxiety. And he, you know, quote unquote, used that for in terms of the performance.
It was amazing. Oh, that
yeah,
ending. We don't even think of it. You guys, if you can find it, I've seen it on TCM, but it doesn't play often, but it is an incredible film, and Rock Hudson, it's a really interesting film, and it's also like you make the connection that a lot of the movies are about Rock being a different person, sort of the you know, one face and another face kind of thing, and I think you're totally right. And in that, you know, he's one person, then he becomes another person, but yet he has to melt back. He's still that one person that he was before. He can't get rid of that. He has to hide it. Yet, it's just a great film. And
it is. And it's very surprising that you would never associate Rock Hudson with a type of film like that.
Never.
Ordinarily.
And I find it sad that he did not get more appreciation then. Now it's thought of as a really good movie and a sort of a cult movie. We went over, forgive me, but I just stepped over The Doorstay, which is his biggest collaboration in film. And they made three incredibly successful films. And I love all of them. I love Pillow Talk is my favorite, I think. And again, you use that how Rex Stetson, you know, and, you know, Rock calls. He's this, like, womanizer. And then Rex comes along, and he then all of a sudden says he likes cooking and he loves his mother and, you know, all this stuff.
Yeah, he says to Doris's character, who's a designer, he said, it must be so interesting working with all them colors and fabrics. <You know? laughs> And he's extending his pinky while he's drinking a martini.
It's so funny. It was so great.
And it's an odd House of Mirrors because you have a gay actor playing a straight actor who's masquerading as a gay guy. So it's, wow, it's, you know, like the ultimate insider joke in a sense. So,
but it's such a great, I love that film.
Yeah, and those movies that he made with Doris are sublime. They're very much of their time, but in some ways they haven't dated at all.
No, they haven't. I love them. I have them all. I have their collection, Doris and Rock collection. And actually, Tony Randall was perfect as their third party. I think they did great. Right. I read once that Tony Randall in one of the films said, hey, let's do a change. How about I play the leading guy and Rock does that? Did you ever hear that?
Yeah, I think Doris has told that story, which is hilarious because, I mean, just think about that for a second, that, you know, Tony Randall would be playing the romantic lead. And,
yeah,
you know,
Rock would be the Tony Randall dude. I don't think so.
Sidekick.
Right? But they were great films, and he and Doris became really great friends.
They do, and I think what's wonderful about that, for my money, I think they're, you know, everyone always pays tribute to Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, and deservedly so. They're a great screen team.
Yes.
But I think, for my money, you know, Rock and Doris are every bit as good.
I agree. I think it's because they did comedy, romantic comedy, that it was not taken as seriously. Do you know what I mean? It was like, oh, fluff. But, you know, it's hard to do those kind of thing and make people and make it believable. And they were great. They were such a great team. And I love those movies. When I feel crappy, I will watch Pillow Talk. I love when they're there and she's in her bathtub and he's in the bathtub and their feet are against the other bathtubs. I just love that movie. It makes me feel good.
Kind of very. Those three films are kind of a cinematic equivalent of comfort food.
They are. Did you talk to Robert Osborne before he died? Because he was a friend of Rock's, and to me, he was my comfort man on TCM. I watched TCM at night or whatever, you know, to go to bed. I didn't want to watch anything bad. And he would be there, and he was like my comfort food man. I loved him.
The late, great Robert Osborne.
Oh, I adore
him for this project. Yeah. Oh, I have such great respect. And, you know, we covered Rock's whole career. And, yeah, as you mentioned, Osborne was good friends with Rock. And, you know, he knew he would see him at the very end of his life when both of them were in Paris. And he didn't realize it at the time. Osborne was visiting his good friend Olivia de Havilland while Rock was sort of secretly taking these experimental AIDS treatments, HPA 23 infusions. And so they happened to run into one another one day on the street, and Osborne didn't realize at the time how grave Hudson's circumstances were. But they ended up going to this wonderful dinner together with Olivia and Rock and a bunch of other mutual friends. And he said, I realized later on that that was, you know, it's a good thing that, you know, this lighthearted, warm dinner took place, because that was a very grim part of Hudson's final days.
Horrible. You know? So let's talk about his ending here. So Tom Clark, what made Rock finally dump Henry Wilson?
I think it was several things in the press. I'm thinking particularly of a Look magazine article where Henry Wilson was starting to say things like, well, I am the man who invented Rock Hudson.
Mm.
Almost like this box of cornflakes. Yes. And, you know, understandably, Rock took umbrage with that and said, well, you know, I couldn't have made it, even if someone gave me the launch, I couldn't have made it on my you know, without having whatever talents I do have or intelligence, you know, I don't think somebody should be claiming credit for all of my success.
Of course not. How silly.
Mm. And then others told me that as we're getting into the early to mid-60s, that Henry's reputation was becoming more and more tarnished, that it was now kind of pretty much very well known within the industry, at least, that if you're going to be a Henry Wilson client, and it's usually some stunning young boy fresh off the bus,
yeah,
then that meant that, as Tony Curtis put it, you'd probably have to sexually express yourself to Henry, I think is how Tony delicately put it. But I think that was starting to, and also, you know, at a certain point, I think Wilson is not as powerful as he had once been. And now that you have the number one star in Rock Hudson, maybe he wasn't working quite as hard as he had before in terms of drumming up great projects
right.
for Rock. Or was, you know, let's not rock the boat, let's put you in another bedroom farce. You know?
With Gina Lollobrigida, yuck. Mm.
Correct, like a come September.
Yeah.
And Wilson may have been discouraging diversification a la Seconds. I don't know that to be exactly true, but I would surmise it.
Yeah.
Because that seems like a very risky project for Rock to take on. So I think when you, in combination, take all of those things, I think it was time for Henry Wilson to go. And I think it was not an amicable parting by all accounts. You know, one of Rock's companions, Lee Garlington, told me that Hudson was always afraid of some sort of retaliatory measure on Wilson's part, where, you know, Rock was afraid, is one of Henry's boys going to throw acid in my face?
Yeah. Also, I heard about it also, just that he was going to sell an article or somebody throw acid in his face that you had in your thing.
Right, right. Or could Wilson go to the press, or was Wilson the one, and this is just a question mark, you know, later when in the early 70s, when these tabloid articles start with this urban legend.
Jim Neighbors.
Mary Jim Neighbors, right. Where did that originate
from?
That
is so sad, yeah. Where do you think it originated from? That is so bizarre.
The common story is that there was a gay couple, and depending on who you talk to, it was Newport Beach, or some people say it was Long Beach, that they would have this party every year. And just as a sort of a backyard joke, somebody concocted this invitation, quote unquote, where the guests were being invited not to a cocktail party, but to the marriage of Rock Hudson and Jim Neighbors. And of course, it's a complete fabrication, but over the, you know, very quickly, for whatever reason, either an invitation, you know, made its way to someone in the press.
A tablet, because it spread all over.
Right.
All over
the
country.
And people believed it. And what's sort of ironic and interesting about that is they were friends, Neighbors and Hudson, but here is Rock sort of being outed for the first time publicly, and it's not for one of his real same-sex relationships. It's for a completely fabricated one. So bizarre as it is, that, and even to this day, some people seem to be convinced of it.
I know. I heard somebody say something. They said that they were in grammar school, and they heard, or like in eighth grade or ninth grade, they heard that rumor. And I'm like, wow, that is something that it just got. It was like hot. You know, it was like fire. It just got out there, and like wired fire. I want to ask you, what premiere was it that Rock went to and people were yelling out faggot to him? Because that was weird.
Yeah, sadly, it was Ice Station Zebra. And according to Mark Miller, who was George Nader's partner, mm-hmm. that was the last time that Rock would ever sort of walk the red carpet, you know, in front of the fans. He would go to other premieres, like later he attended the premiere of Darling Lily with Julie Andrews, but I don't think he would ever subject himself to that long walk down the red carpet where the fans can kind of shout out or greet you. And that was maybe the first time, at least that I can think of, where, you know, homophobic slurs are chanted at the star of a film in public.
Yeah. You know what? What I felt was the timing. What's his face was canned. Did he hire
Henry
people
Wilson
to do that? Because really, no one ever did it before. Nobody ever did it really after.
Right. So you wonder about that. Is this the ultimate revenge? You know, that did Henry Wilson start this sort of thing happening? That I don't know. I wouldn't want to,
of course, say that
for certain.
I'm saying in my head, right. I have no idea, but I put that together. It's like, why did that never happen before? Why is it happening now? And why did it happen then after he was canned? So, and didn't also Tom Clark get drunk after Rock dumped him? Who was on? Oh, Claire Trevor was with him on a plane to New York. And didn't he get drunk
right.
and he shouted out something about Rock being gay or something?
Right. According to Mark Miller, when Tom Clark, you know, was banished from the castle for a while, he got on a plane and Claire Trevor was sort of playing caretaker
yeah.
to make sure that Clark was escorted to New York City, where Rock had an apartment at the Beresford, this luxury apartment building. And apparently on the whole flight from California to New York, Tom Clark was sort of loudly and belligerently telling fellow passengers about his long-term affair with Rock Hudson and how it had gone sour. And very sad, you know, this is somebody who was, you know, speaking when they're intoxicated. And, you know, that was probably, for the other people on the plane, it was probably their first inkling that some of these rumors about Hudson could actually be authentic.
But it's amazing it never got out, that nobody went to the press and said this was what happened on our plane.
Right, right. And, they, you know, the sad thing in researching Rock's story is how often he was either blackmailed or the victim of an extortion plot.
Rotten creeps. Yes.
Yeah.
So sad.
You know, companions. Yeah, and it just happens repeatedly throughout his life.
It
so.
Must made him sick inside. I mean, how can you live that way? That has to torture you, that you don't know who to trust. You know, that mm-hmm. you're this huge star, that, you know, you're this hunka burn and love cute guy, and you're an idol, and God forbid it got out, because I'm saying there are still men today who are in the closet that are leading men, but it's mm-hmm. a whole different atmosphere, but they are, because there's still a lot of people who are homophobic. It's not as acceptable. But then forget it, Charlie. And so he really had to be like on his toes all the time. Like, is this guy going to do it to me? I mean, it just was heartbreaking to me that he couldn't be who he could be freely.
Yeah, you'd sort of be constantly nervously glancing over your shoulder, Grace. You know, like, who can I trust? Who's going to stab me in the back? Who's
can I go out in public with this one? Yeah, and he did get extorted a lot, and he did get blackmailed. And I exactly like you said about Phyllis Gates still sending the bills. Come on. So let's mm-hmm. talk about when Rock gets older and the parts he plays as he gets older. And his box office is kind of down. He's, you know, he's an older man now. He's getting a little paunchy. Let's
right.
get to that part.
He still has that sort of indefinable Rock Hudson appeal. He's still very charismatic.
Oh,
and he's,
big
he's
time.
Still photogenic, but he is aging. And so this is in the late 60s, and a few things are happening. He, again, tries to take on several different types of films. He does this quasi-musical with Julie Andrews, Darling Lily, which everyone has enormously high hopes for. That proves to be a disappointment. He does a Western with John Wayne, The Undefeated, and everyone thought, well, okay, we're going to put the two huge male stars together, the Duke and Rock. How could that miss? And it performs respectably, but it's not the blockbuster that they had anticipated. And, you know, he makes a couple of films with Claudia Cardinale that do okay, but not spectacularly. So all of a sudden he finds himself, the feature film career is in a downslide. And I think a significant part of what's happening there is this was the era of counterculture stars like Dustin Hoffman, Jack Nicholson, Al Pacino.
You didn't have to be, they were shrimps and not good looking. I thought Al had
right,
kind of something about him, but, you know, you didn't have to be a good-looking, tall, strapping hunk to be a leading man. So you're right.
Exactly. Yeah, so you don't have to look like Rock Hudson to be a movie star
no.
anymore.
Mm-mm.
And I think to the Woodstock generation, they're looking at Rock Hudson as someone that their parents had gone to see.
Right.
So there's this feeling of, well, do we want to go see a Rock Hudson movie? That's sort of like an antique to us. So quite wisely, I think Rock said, well, it's time to do something very different. And then came this invitation to do television with Macmillan and Wife. And boy, does that prove to be a really important transition for him.
My father loved that show. He used to watch it.
Yeah, it's really fun and offbeat and kind of quirky.
Susan St. James.
Susan St. James, John Chuck, Nancy Walker.
What a great crew. Yeah.
Yeah, they're a wonderful ensemble. And then you mix in all of these amazing guest stars.
I like love the Cap Satanist Hunter. Stuff. Yes, Dana Wood, all these people. I just loved it.
Yeah.
They had some great Cara Dulay. And then they had the older group as well. But it was, I think it was, my father loved Columbo, Macmillan and Wife. Mm-hmm. It was like, wasn't it like once a month, mystery TV or something like that?
Yeah, it's like the Sunday night, NBC Sunday night mystery movie. And it's in a rotation with, as you mentioned, Columbo. And I think, what was it, Dennis?
Weaver. What was his name? McLeod. McLeod.
There you go. Yes. And I remember John Shuck telling me that the first season, they sort of rode in on the coattails of Peter Fox Columbo. Mm-hmm. And it was in the second season where the audience really latched onto Macmillan and Wife and said, well, this is a gem in its own right. And a lot of Rock's fans believe that the chemistry with Susan St. James was just every bit as good as it was with Doris Day.
I thought they had great chemistry. If you see it now, and it's just, in your book you describe, Susan was a flower child. She named her kid Sunshine or something. But then she ended up marrying Dick Ebersole, so we know she went a different route there. But at that time, she was like groovy, whatever, peace, love. And Rock was a smoker, a drinker, he was from a different generation.
She's eating soybean soup and he's consuming steak, so they're like polar opposites. But I think very wisely, Rock figured out that that was going to work to the betterment of the show.
And it did. He chose wisely because they had a lot of women up for that part.
Diane Keaton, Jill Clayburgh, amazing, who auditioned for that.
Yeah. I can't see him with Rock. I thought that was I thought that they were cute and believably married and just really, my father loved all those things. And you can still find them, Macmillan and Wife. And they're just, they're sweet and they're good. And, you just love, what's her name? The Bounty Lady.
Nancy Walker.
I love her. She's so fab.
And she and Rock were real good friends in real life.
Yeah, she was really great friends with Montgomery Clift as well, or James Dean. I don't know. She was really good friends with those guys. One of them.
She had good taste.
She did. Oh, we never even talked about Giant.